Welcome to Trax Cultures. I'm Mike Picanato, your host. This podcast unravels the intricacies of transitions across cultures. For those feeling the pull of change or supporting loved ones through it, this podcast is for you. We understand the uncertainty and excitement that come with such transitions, and together we'll explore how to adapt while maintaining community and belonging. Throughout our episodes, we'll draw on insights from the Cross-Cultural Transition Handbook by Dr. Stephen W. Jones. Whether you're moving to a new place or supporting someone who is, this podcast offers encouragement and connection. Enjoy the conversations as we navigate the challenges and joys of cross-cultural transitions together.
Well, hello and welcome to Joel, Kate, and Stephen, and we are all sitting in the same room.
What?
Hey.
Hello, hello.
I know, it's amazing. I am really happy that we're able to record again. And maybe before we launch into the material that we want to cover, just talk to me a little bit, Joel and Kate, about what it's like to be in Berlin and how that process of moving has been for you guys.
It's amazing here. The process is difficult for sure. I'm finding even as things are difficult and frustrating, there's still so much that's stimulating and exciting that it feels kind of balanced at the moment. It helps, yeah, just kind of even everything out when things are new and fun, and then you go home and things are frustrating and challenging and confusing.
I think once we get our big delivery of furniture today, it'll feel more like home. Because right now it still feels like vacation because we're living out of suitcases and
we have two chairs
and two chairs. Yeah. And it just, yeah, it feels like we're on a fun vacation right now with the overhead of like, oh no, we're not leaving. And so it just feels a little unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Having your own furniture will help for sure.
But
even then it'll be new, right?
So right. It'll still be new furniture. It'll still, yeah, it won't be home. And
this is somebody else's nice vacation apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Brand new furniture here.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're getting there though. It does feel like now our apartment, it has been 2 weeks. It does feel like a comforting place to end the day. And
that's
so
good.
that mm-hmm. is a really good thing. It is a warm, inviting place.
Yeah. The train this morning, it was nice to, you know, kind of have to glance at the directions. And then, you know, once we got to the first tram stop, it was kind of, we remembered where to go. It was nice.
Starting to be on autopilot
a little bit. So I recognized this older gal that was at the same station. I remember somebody had mentioned that you notice you're on the same routine as other people. There's a kid that has a really interesting gait that rides the train with us over here to this stop. And then, yeah, I don't know, just starting to recognize people's patterns and mm-hmm. just see other people in our lives that are going to be recurring, it seems like.
We flew 2 weeks before you guys did. And I think Alyssa said yesterday, I still feel like I haven't quite arrived. And so
sure.
It's exhausting too.
The travel alone was traumatic
was
because the dogs, like we got on the plane and we could hear our dogs howling underneath. And
it was awful.
It was terrible.
It was heartbreaking.
Like, I imagined like leaving a kid at daycare for the first time or mm-hmm. something. Like, they're going to be fine. This is going to be awful for them. But oh my gosh, that was terrible to hear them howling down there. And they got all the other dogs that were on the flight with them. You could just,
it had
to be so loud down there.
Mm.
And then when we got to the airport here in Berlin, it was just, we were, you know, you'd been flying all day and you're exhausted and we could, all of a sudden we were at baggage claim and we could hear the dogs again. And so we went running over to where they were and they were, they were a mess and they were.
The people at large baggage claim were not helpful and it was just,
so we felt really alone.
It was really warm in there and the air conditioning, it's like I was already sweating because I was stressed out and then, yeah.
It was so stressful. I'm like yelling at people for scissors and just trying to get the dogs out of their cages. But everything.
And then we're at one place waiting for you and you come out the other.
Yeah, so yeah. There's always confusion as to like, where are you and how do we get to each other?
I also needed to get 180 pounds of dog outside immediately. Goodness and I went gracious. To the nearest door and Mike's like, wrong door. I'm like, I don't care. I am going outside.
Other priorities at the moment.
And it was more like, okay, Well, just where are you so we can find you?
I was like, I don't know. I can't read anything.
Yeah. The getting here was wild. It was, I mean, I think a lot of like the months leading up to this was normal amounts of stress and anxiety and sadness and things like that. But then I think it was the morning we left. We had breakfast with our niece and nephew and then dropped them back off. And then I got back home and I just started bawling. I couldn't stop crying. I hadn't felt like that up until that point. Mm-hmm. That was surprising. That doesn't happen very often. So yeah, that leaving the house was a lot harder than I thought. And taking the dogs away from the house.
Yeah.
And taking Kate away too. Like putting us all in a car and driving to Denver to go get on a plane was that it all hit at this like just one spot the day we left.
So did you drive 8 hours then from the
house? Yeah. And then we drove to Denver and Kate got this fantastic hotel that had a like a patio that you could walk out so the dogs could they didn't have to like walk through the hotel constantly. Mm. And then got on the plane the next day. It was hard. It wasn't super, super difficult, but it was emotionally taxing. And
we've never done it before. It was frustrating.
Yeah, it was just so new and not fun new stuff at all. I hope we never have to do that again.
Well, there are those moments where everything becomes increasingly real.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can read about it online on, you know, other people's experiences and the second you're in it though, it's just.
Well, even everything in the Denver airport felt foreign. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't, everything felt like, what am I doing? Where am I going? Where do I take the dogs? Are mm-hmm. they okay?
Yeah. There was just, there's so much more. It wasn't, you know, catching a flight to, you know, Orlando to go on vacation or something. This was the next step in a new life.
And we realized this morning that Joel forgot half of his pants.
Yeah.
I set them out for him.
The left half or the right half?
I am, man.
Top I need half, like, actually.
With my legs, yeah.
I had set them out for him, and I remember him leaving the laundry room saying, all right, I'm all packed. And I thought, oh, that's weird. He's leaving all those pants.
Like in Omaha.
Yep.
So I'm walking around the apartment today and I'm like, Kate, do you know where my pants are? I can only find like three pairs of pants. And she's like, you know, you think you left them in Omaha. So I don't know. I have to get some of my pants to some short-term teams coming in. slowly bring my pants back to Germany.
There's someone from Omaha coming to visit their daughter this December, and he was like, is there any small things you want me to bring? I was like, yes, Reese's peanut butter cups.
And my pants.
And Joel's pants. Yeah.
Well, we want to also kind of continue to help people process this cross-cultural transitions, and so it's great to have Dr. Stephen W. Jones with us today to help work through some of the material in his book, The Cross-Cultural Transition Handbook. And the chapters we wanted to look at both for this episode and then the next one really deal with some of these factors of intensifying and increasing risk. So intensifying the experience and increasing the risk. And some of them will probably feel really familiar to you as we as we go through them. But Stephen, could you kind of introduce the idea of the factors that intensify the experience?
Yeah, definitely. So these are not original to me. These are from R. Michael Page, the late R. Michael Page, who taught at the University of Minnesota. I think that not all cross-cultural transitions are the same for all sorts of reasons. You know, everybody experiences them differently, but also looking at what are the factors about your particular sojourn that make it more intense can be helpful in kind of trying to, I don't know, identify like the shape of the transition that you're experiencing. And so I think, yeah, this list from Michael Page is really helpful for that. So I think I'll just kind of walk through them a little bit.
Sure.
And
be great.
Yeah. So the first is that the more cultural difference there is between where you're coming from and where you're landing, the more intense the experience. And that is not always obvious at first, like where those cultural differences lie. One of the issues we see as people move across cultures is very often there's an underestimation of the difference. And so people will tend to assume more similarity than there actually is. And so at first you might think, oh yeah, this is familiar. I can shop with my credit card. Maybe I can't read the signs, but they at least sort of look familiar. I can kind of figure my way around. I know how to walk down the sidewalk or whatever.
Half the people here understand me.
Right. Yeah. Especially in a place where there's a lot of English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can kind of get by with English. And so like at first, some of those differences are really masked. The longer you're in a place, the more that kind of gets pulled back. Like even a couple of days ago, you're asking, what do I do with my cardboard recycling?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you can't do anything today because it's Sunday. And that idea is so unusual. I mean, I guess I suppose that there are places in the States where you can't do anything on a Sunday too.
Sure.
But it wasn't only that. I was like, you can't do anything because it's Sunday, but also the place that we go is closed till November. Right. And it's September. So and this is like super normal here that for whatever reason, this thing is just closed, but that's not normal. But like what brochure about German culture is that going to be on?
No. Yeah. Yeah. That's just the understood things and maybe it's not. Yeah. Not understood, but just things like back home, I would just. Yeah. There's a lot with the giant recycling thing and you just take your stuff there because. Mm-hmm.
Well, there is here too.
Yeah. But, yeah. But it's different.
Yeah.
And that's.
Well, you said you can walk down the street. It's like not necessarily some of the sidewalks have bike lanes on it, but and you have to know which ones do. Yeah,
that was a trick comment.
Oh, was it? Oh, my God. I was like, actually, well it done, is indeed. Not the same.
Yeah, because like even trying to figure out, I there are times where still I've been here over 4 years now, and I still sometimes can't tell what's going on with left or right of the sidewalk, right? Like,
yeah,
it's just, it's fascinating.
That is a question I had. When you're meeting someone on the sidewalk, crossing them, are you supposed to go to the right or the left? Because I notice a lot of people go to the opposite side that I think they should go on.
It's super confusing here. There seems to be no rule about it. And
Would that come from, that was probably something we would touch on anyway today, but. I've been thinking about a town like Berlin, a city like Berlin that has so many different cultures living here. The idea of one thing going, I would imagine that those things get a lot blurrier in a city like that.
We had longtime workers who in Germany that used to come to the church where I was pastoring, and they would say, "Hey, I can't speak for Germany; I can only speak for Berlin." And so Alyssa has also kind of adopted that. And so when people ask, "Well, what is it like in Germany?" we have to say, "Well, I can't tell you what it's like in Germany; I can only say what it's like in Berlin." And I can say, in Berlin, walking down a sidewalk is chaos, especially if there's a lot of people. There seems to be no particular rule as to what side you go on. Or what side you walk your dog on, or
right.
And I would, yeah, in my head, I'm thinking, there are probably just dozens of rules.
Yeah.
Depending on who you're walking, you know, towards.
Yep.
I think one of the things that's really interesting about cultural difference being an intensity factor is that even if you view the difference positively, it's still an intensity factor.
Oh yeah.
Right. So like you guys have mentioned the availability of certain kinds of food here. Right.
Yeah.
And that's a positive difference, but it's still an intensity factor in that it's different than what you're used to. Mm-hmm. It changes things. Like a difference that you might encounter as you start to, especially as you start to understand more German, like some of the ways the law is set up here and is practiced here has this really core humanizing principle in it, which is partially a response to what happened during the war and the Nazi times. And I think there's some really, really good stuff in there that I really appreciate humanly. And at the same time, it is different than what I'm used to. And so even though it's a difference I appreciate, it still is an intensity factor in the sense that it's like, okay, I don't actually know quite how this works. And then it also intensifies your experience of your relationship to back home, wherever that is. Because then you're thinking about, oh, there's a different way of being human in the world. And why did we choose one way and this culture chose a different way?
Kate made a comment the other day that it sums all that up. Just noticing that there are other brands of cars. Like we thought we knew all the car brands. We're not car people, but it's like, okay, you have like five choices and that's it. And then you see somebody driving a, you know, a Bingo or something. It's like, what? What?
That's an American car.
There's a Skoda. Where's the Skoda? Yeah, it's
like if my understanding of something so simple could just get flipped like that. Mm-hmm. And make me question what I know.
There's also this interesting interplay between what is legal and what is friendly. Mm-hmm. For example, it's friendly to put your bottles underneath the trash can so that people who are collecting the bottles to return them for the deposit money don't have to rummage through the trash. But the Ordnungsamt says that that's illegal. which means they could technically ticket you for doing something that is friendly. Mm. Or they kind of have a culture of giving things away on the street in a lot of neighborhoods in Berlin. So mm-hmm. if you're not using something, you set it out. But the neighbor lady that came by and talked to me today was complaining about the fact that nobody had taken that little piece of furniture that's sitting next to the entrance to the courtyard at our building. And I'm not sure if she was just complaining or looking for a solution, but I offered a solution and said, hey, we've got to go to the recycling center anyway. If it's still there when I go, I'll just take it with. And that just made her day. And those are sometimes the cultural things that you run into. Mm-hmm. Somebody was being friendly and put that out, but other neighbors are seeing it as being rude because now there's trash on the street that nobody wants.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. Like feeding your meter back home, right? Or feeding somebody else's meter. That's kind of an old school thing. It's all electronic now, but in the States, it mm-hmm. it's you can get a ticket for popping a quarter in someone's expired meter.
Funny.
Yeah.
Another intensity factor is your level of intercultural competence. And so in general, the less interculturally competent you are, the more intense the experience is, but not necessarily because you comprehend what's happening, but rather because you don't. But there's also a flip side of that, depending on like where you're at in intercultural development, there is a stage where things get way more intense as you become more interculturally competent. That stage is called acceptance. And in that stage, there's kind of this like, oh my goodness, everything is way, way more complicated than I ever realized. And so not everybody who moves across cultures experiences that stage. Many people don't. But if you're intentionally moving through developing your intercultural competence and you hit that stage of acceptance, then it becomes really intense. But the reason that it's more intense at lower levels of intercultural competence are just because you're using your culture's way of understanding the world in a place where that's not how the world is understood. And so your map may have familiar features on it, like, oh, they shake hands here. I know how to shake hands, right? But like, what is the meaning of a handshake? Mm. Or, oh yeah, sometimes people greet each other on the street. I can greet people on the street. But then knowing like, when do you and when don't you and why? Mm. Those kinds of things, the less interculturally competent you are, the less likely you are to accurately perceive those things. And then, of course, if you're at a stage of intercultural competence that involves you having a lot of prejudice either against the other culture or against your own culture, that makes it more intense because that seeing everything through these kind of polarized lenses, I feel like it's by definition intense. It's, you know, because you're looking for the us versus them, where's the threat?
Sure.
Those kinds of things. But I think even when you're in the kind of the middle stage of intercultural competence, minimization, there is a lot of times intensity that you recognize after the fact. And so like where you're interacting with people, assuming that you're having the same experience, and then maybe later you realize like, oh, we weren't having the same experience at all.
Sure.
And then you start questioning everything, right? And so that can also be intense.
For more on that, see Stephen's upcoming book, Being Intercultural, released in hopefully January. Or, well, early February.
That's news to me.
Early.
I was thinking April, so.
Second quarter 2026. Yeah. So, Stephen, as I've watched you do the IDI tests with people and have gone through that with you myself, would you say it's safe to say that everybody overestimates their level of intercultural ability?
Nearly everybody. There are some people who either don't or who don't do so significantly enough that we would say, okay, yeah, that's actually happening. But most people do, and sometimes really significantly. So like on this 5-stage test, sometimes you'll see people who are estimating their level of intercultural competence as a full stage or even 2 beyond where they are.
Which intensifies the experience as well.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Because if you're like, no, I got this figured out, which a lot of times, especially like when you get to the point where you're moving overseas, you're like, well, I must be pretty interculturally competent because like, look at me, you know, none of my neighbors are doing this from back home. So there's just this idea like, oh, I must be relatively interculturally competent. But like moving overseas doesn't mean you're interculturally competent. It just means you moved overseas.
Right.
You could be moving overseas precisely because you're not interculturally competent, right? Like you could be moving because you're like, no, my culture is better than everybody else's and I'm going to go spread it with the world. And if that's what you're doing, that's not interculturally competent.
Sure.
And so, yeah. But
or the opposite. I mean, we're seeing a lot of people coming into Berlin now even that are saying my culture is awful.
Right. That my culture is uniquely bad in human history and is a particularly awful kind of humanity and worse than everything else. And so therefore, I need to adopt everything else without understanding it. And that, of course, creates all sorts of problems.
Mm. Yeah.
You mean like they adopt their new cultures?
They think they do.
That's interesting. Very cool. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. And there might be really great things in the host culture. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
But if you're adopting them uncritically without understanding them or without understanding what they mean to the people who are from there, it gets all sorts of awkward.
Yeah. You're almost, you're bordering on, maybe not even, you're flirting with like appropriation or almost like playing dress up in a way.
Yeah. Playing dress up's a good word for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just noticing that with public transportation, the rush to be first is a lot more than in Omaha, Nebraska, I guess. Maybe it's human nature, but the rush to make sure you get on the bus before somebody else, like in my mind, that's rude. But then in a Christian view, it's just like, well, if I wait too long, then I'm not going to be on the bus. And then, so I do need to push myself on there. And yeah, I don't know. It's been something I've been thinking about every day when I'm like, geez, everyone's kind of rude.
Yeah. Another possibility is that everybody's being polite because they're trying to keep everybody else from being held up.
Mm.
Sure.
Like the quicker I get on the bus, the quicker everybody can go somewhere and we won't miss the light. And so we won't have to wait another cycle.
Mm. Yeah. But again, it's these different places that we've come from.
It's interesting when we have short-term teams here, often they don't get on the trams or the buses quick enough. And then they end up holding doors, which is illegal, and they could get fined €60 for that.
Oh. I got punched in the back of the head on my first trip here getting on the train because I wasn't moving quick enough.
Got punched in the back of the head?
Yeah.
Ow.
Was that me?
No. It's some gnarly looking skinhead dude. He gave me an elbow across the back of my head. Yeah.
Well, he probably thought you looked like you should know better.
What are some of the other?
So language is another intensity factor, and you're probably experiencing that. In fact, on our drive from the airport to your apartment, you were like, these signs are different, right? Like,
yeah.
And just this recognition of like, okay, things are happening here where there's information right in front of my face and I don't know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really intense. There is this sense in which, especially when you have the goal of learning the language, that process can be really, really intense because it drags you through the mud of incompetence. And so that's very intense. At the same time, like, I don't know, there's these interesting caveats with the intensity around language. Sometimes if you have a good interpreter who's doing linguistic translation for you, that actually decreases the intensity because sometimes they buffer you from cultural realities.
Sure. Yeah. We've experienced that already.
And so like sometimes you have less intensity when you have no competence and somebody who can translate for you. But if you yourself are responsible for interacting with the language and the language is different, it really increases the intensity.
Mm.
And that's everything from like, oh no, my phone is ringing. I really don't want to answer it. Like, I don't like to answer the phone in the States anyway. Like,
sure.
In my own language, I don't like answering the phone. But like my first few years here, I was like, oh, I really do not want to be on this phone call.
Man, I'm 13 years in and my heart rate goes up when my phone rings from a German number because you lose so much of the language. I mean, you lose all the body language and all the facial cues and you're just dealing with voice.
Well, and when you call someone, there would probably be an assumption that they speak the language that you do. And so like the idea of the person calling you is probably going to speak at a pace and, you know, that they don't understand that you're trying to figure out what they're saying. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They hear our accent and know pretty quickly.
There you go.
You guys are 2 weeks in. How are you doing with, I mean, you'll start language school next week.
Mm-hmm.
People are really respond well because I can say in German, I'm sorry, I only speak English. And they're very, very forgiving for that. So far, they have been, especially, I think I've mostly said that at the pet store and then like ordering food. And that's actually gone pretty well. I can say enough where like, can I drink this here? Is it okay if I point? And what I've found is that most people are not native Berliners anyway. And so everyone is like their second language or probably third and fourth is German. And they're more forgiving, which has been nice. But then not knowing the culture of like tone and exaggeration, like when our dogs were first here and we left them too long, too soon. And they were howling. And then our landlord called Mike and he was like frustrated. And from where I am, like if a landlord is like angry, that's a threat. And Mike is like, no, he's exaggerating. That's just what he's doing. And I was like, well, that feels like a lie to me. Like, I feel like he is lying. And Mike's like, no, that's not a big deal. And I'm panicking. And it was just not knowing how people communicate. Mm-hmm.
And then the layer of linguistically not having the ability to communicate with him directly.
Correct.
And then culturally not knowing how the communication happens and what the meaning of it is. Like those two layers come together.
Yeah. It was just extremely, like, not disorienting.
Unsettling.
It was extremely unsettling. Yeah, it felt like a threat immediately. And I was like, didn't know what to do with that.
I think there's also this sense in which, like in that situation and many others, you kind of by default become dependent on other people.
Right.
In ways that really limits your own agency.
Yeah, it's not comfortable at all. Because, you're saying, you have to say, like, man, that's, I think, talking about where we're having an interpreter, it almost makes it worse. Mm. It's good to have someone say, like, no, this is the situation. It'll be fine, but you want to be able to explain things. You want to be able to, like, show how you also understand the situation and that you're trying or something, and you're unable to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a peacekeeper, just deep down. And when I can't do that, it's so confusing and frustrating that I can't keep the peace. I can't be the one that's like calming the situation.
Even though we're the problem in that specific one.
Right. I couldn't do anything about it.
Mm-mm.
There's also this sense of a lot of new workers start in their 20s, but that's not the case for any of us. And so all of us came as adults who had been functioning in careers to the field with a certain level of competency and expectancy of ourselves, and then to become so reliant on other people also has a weird feeling to it, because you're like, I need other people to do all of these things for me. Mm. And there are times where you're just wanting to say, I can do this myself. And when you, whether it's because of language or because of cultural things, realize you can't, it intensifies the experience, because there's an embarrassment that comes with that, even if that's more perceived than real. It's just part of the experience.
It also feels like that's pushed me to pump the brakes a little bit too. Just not being able to do things in any way like I used to. It's forced us to slow down in how quickly we move through the day. So
that was like a frustration this morning.
What's that?
Just like things were so easy and now they're not.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like frustrated crying this morning, because I'm like, oh man, things were peaceful. I had peace like 2 years ago. And then Joel came to Berlin. And so, yeah, I feel frustrated today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna pull several of these together because they kind of go in similar directions. So the degree to which you're immersed in the host culture, how much previous intercultural experience you have, how visible you are in the culture, and the perceived status or relative status that you have in the host culture are all things that increase the intensity. There's, I think, this sense in which, like, you guys are, you're not going in as deeply as you could in the sense that you're not, like, working for a German company and only interacting with German people, right? But as far as, like, the scale of immersion goes, you're pretty far down toward the deep end.
Sure,
And then previous intercultural experience, like your previous experience in Germany, is relatively limited.
There's
cross-cultural experience. I mean, Omaha has a lot of different things happening culturally if you know where to look.
Yeah.
If you choose to.
If you choose to engage. Yeah.
Pretty mild compared to here, though.
But that definitely, you know, if you're used to kind of being surrounded by people who, for the most part, interact with the world similarly to you, and then you're now in a place where that's different, just that situation can be jarring. And then relative visibility. In this case, you have the issue of relative invisibility, where it's not necessarily obvious from looking at you whether you're from here or not. And so sometimes if you become a visible minority and you're not used to that, yeah, that can increase intensity. On the other hand, if you're used to being a visible minority and suddenly become not one, that can increase intensity.
Sure.
And also, if you're not used to being a visible minority and then you're still not a visible minority, that can increase intensity. It's just all differently, right? The way in which it's increasing the intensity. And then status when people look at you. Berlin's a little bit weird in that way, in that I feel like a lot of status markers are hidden in Berlin.
Yeah, I've been noticing that. It's kind of hard to tell what's going on just looking at the surface.
Yeah, I actually really like that.
Yeah, I do too.
Rereading these chapters this morning, it was, and I was talking to it last night with, is it Carissa? About how it was nice to be at Mauer Park and like not be known. Because in Omaha, I like, because we go to a big church and part of the art community and all that, we always run into someone we know, and it's nice to like not be known all the time. And like, I could just like, just be and slowly look at all the different vendors and whatnot. And yeah, I was worried about that, not being known here, because it is, that was such a part of my identity in Omaha. And then being here where nobody knows me, it's actually kind of nice.
I mentioned these next two already, but they're probably worth revisiting. One is agency, right? So do you have, your own agency? And in some ways, yeah, like you can do whatever you want, right? Like
sure.
You're adults and you can just do your thing, you know? And on the other hand, you're really dependent on people.
Right.
And that can be really tough. And then that connects to team relationships, when you have to manage relationships with a team. And then especially when you have dependencies on that team, that can really increase intensity. At the same time that the team can provide a lot of support and provide a lot of sense of even kind of built-in community or a sense of identity and belonging, there's also this sense of like, oh man, who are these people? like what did we get ourselves into? And we're dependent on them.
Yeah.
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 And this, I remember when we first came, our first couple of weeks, we were so dependent on, especially that first week, so dependent on the team leader's wife who helped us with a lot of things. But it got to the point where if we had questions on how something would work, our youngest son, who was only six, would be like, well, call Sarah. If you don't know the answer to something, call Sarah. Sarah will know the answer to everything. And there's a sense of, yeah, but I want to know answers myself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And especially if competency is a high value for you, where you begin to feel like, I'm never going to get this, or I just want to prove my competency to my team. When we've all been through it, we've all know.
Right.
Yeah, these are intense times. We've been in those incompetent situations too. But it's new to the incoming worker in that situation. They haven't felt that incompetent in a long time.
I don't know how to pay rent. I don't know how to pay, set up electricity or my cell phone. And so we are depending on you. And yeah, it's just, it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is a normal thing. I should be able to just pay rent normally. But I can't read the German that's like, to where do I send it? And
yeah. I got stressed out and embarrassed last night when I'd, we all got together for dinner and you said, you know, dinner's at 7, but I didn't know, does that mean show up at 7 or is that, would that be rude or do you need to be there at 6:45? And so it's like, but I felt like I was asking you guys like the millionth question for the day. And well, yeah. And I know it's not the case, but it's like, you want to be better at it than you are. And you want to prove that you can actually do something instead of having to ask you a question. Like, I know you said 7 o'clock, but what do you really mean by that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even then, as you saw last night, all the people that came had different definitions of what that meant. Yeah.
I think that I came up with the last three of these. I can't remember. So one is romance between you and anybody else. So like even like your own relationship with each other becomes an intensity factor. It's also a huge support, right? But there's like this need to negotiate your relationship where the like everything has changed around you. And so a lot of your own identity is potentially at risk or in flux in some way. And then that's also the case for the other person. And so, yeah, maintaining a sense of us can be challenging, really good. And also in some ways can be really fun because you can discover new ways of being yourselves. But there's also the sense of like, man, like this is hard.
And we sent out an update letter yesterday to our supporters, and we Kate had written the majority of the letter, and she mentioned that we recognized that we had started laughing together again, like at things. We had gone like over a week probably,
where
it was just
longer.
Too stressful, yeah. And we just nothing was funny. We found nothing funny together, and then it slowly started like coming back, and that's been really nice.
Alyssa and I have noticed in the process that often we're one of us is able to carry the other when they're down. Like, we're not both mm-hmm. down at the same time, but when we're both down at the same time in that process, then yeah.
The living environment is another intensity factor that I think I added. So like right now in Berlin, like the living environment is super pleasant. It's kind of cool in the morning, gets a little warm in the afternoon. It's, you know, today it's sunny.
It's been sunny. We were planning on, not to interject here, but we were planning on gray and depressing, and it has been sunny and gorgeous every single day we've been here so far. So
except for Friday.
Yeah, whatever. I don't even remember it. That's how good it's been.
Friday, it was like depressing and gray and very heavy feeling. And it was like just this tiny foretaste of what winter will be like. and so I think for those of us who know Berlin winter intimately, it was just like, oh no, I'm not ready for this.
I was working on finances the whole day. The weather matched my mood.
it was actually you. It was your fault. But I think there's this way in which, like, even just the weather being different than what you're used to is an intensity factor, but then also the weather for its own sake or the living environment. Berlin overall is a relatively quiet city. Mm-hmm. You guys probably noticed the difference, like, it's in traffic noise. Mm-hmm. But even that is different, right? Or like how you get around, like you guys just got bikes and learning to get around the city on bikes. Like, there is an intensity to that. There are ways in which it's nice and it's very freeing, and other ways in which it's like this. Sometimes it's an easy day biking and sometimes it's not.
Right. Like, I don't have a helmet yet, so I don't feel comfortable going too far. And then also one of us has to go back to accept the furniture delivery. And then I told Joel I'm afraid to ride alone still. And so it was like, can we please take the train still? And yeah, so I'm excited for the freedom of a bike. But I also I'm not a bike person.
It brought on new anxiety.
Yeah, like, I'm not a biker. Yeah. I'm not a biker. So, yeah. Or a cyclist.
Yeah. These streets are sketchy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got bucked off my bike by a tree root.
Like, there are signs that tell you that the way is damaged, so it's fine.
So much money in those signs. So they don't have to invest money in street and sidewalk repair.
The way is damaged.
But I can't read that sign.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, whose fault is that?
Well, now it's yours.
Speaking of team problems. Yeah. But that living environment, I think obviously we'll try to, even things like how you take care of yourself, right? So like that hot water is really expensive here has changed our family's patterns around showers in the winter, which is one of the main ways we warmed up, right? Like, there's just these random things that are just different, or the lack of screens on windows I really like. Mm-hmm. But when the wasps are around in late August, beginning of September, or when they start to live in your balcony, which happened to us, and then the landlord doesn't do anything about it, then, you know, then like part of our living environment right now is that every time we go outside, there are probably 15 wasps that fly in front of us. We've only gotten stung a couple of times, but like still, it's like intense, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We had one get into our living room a couple nights ago. They're big.
I had one get in bed with me.
Ugh.
Yeah. I thought I dreamed that I got stung and then I had real stings and I was like, oh
goodness.
Well, and you guys had problems with your, with those, the roll down, things that come in front of the windows, and we did too.
Yeah.
And it just takes forever to get them repaired.
So for our boys' room, the shutters that come down got stuck down. Ours are motorized and it broke. And so the whole summer, literally the boys' whole vacation, their shutters didn't come up.
No. So then you couldn't have light in the room. You couldn't. No. Yeah. And for ours, that happened too. And it was weeks and weeks before.
And these are like teenage and preteen boys, right? Like, you know,
their room needed some air.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Awful.
The last one I want to mention is the spiritual environment. And this is something that I don't think we have necessarily super language to describe, but the recognition that we're engaged with a spiritual reality. There's stuff going on that we can't see. And so, yeah, not only is the spiritual climate different here than it is where you're coming from, but also there's this sense of having to navigate the unseen, or at least being affected by it.
I read somewhere recently that the earth remembers the sins that took place in a certain place. And that's just as true in Omaha as it is here. There have been terrible things that have happened in these different places, and you run into the reality of that in different ways.
It's surprising how deep scars go mm-hmm. on a people, you know, on a people that I would venture most of the people that you know, 99% of the people that live here currently haven't been here, you know, their lifetime.
It would be different in this neighborhood.
In this neighborhood, I would drop that percentage considerably.
Sure,
yeah.
but Berlin as a city is largely, it's people that have moved here.
About what is the number that we show? It's about 20-30% of the people come from different countries.
Yeah, and then there's a bunch of people from other parts of Germany.
Yeah, yeah, it's a city that people move to and
away from.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. But like, yeah, the things that you can experience, even though you didn't go through it personally or didn't grow up with it, right? That you can still come here and feel that weight, that you can come here and just sense that heaviness here.
So around the corner from Sprig, there are four of the Stolpersteine, the
stumbling stones
that commemorate a family that was taken away and murdered in the Holocaust. And I remember in my first several months here, I had become aware of those stones, that they were there. And I live on the same street as those stones. I remember waking up and then in the middle of the night, almost like in terror with this recognition of they've taken my neighbors away. Mm. And in terms of chronology, that's not true, right? Like my contemporary neighbors, that didn't happen to. But in terms of like, yeah, these are people who, if I had lived here at a different time, we would have crossed each other, you know, crossed paths on the street or shopped at the same store or whatever. And so just the awareness of that, you know, I don't know that I've necessarily resolved any of that, but the way that the horrors of what's happened in a place settle into the place and settle into you. Definitely.
Yeah.
And I don't think the answer to that is to take away the Stolpersteine. I think that it's really important that they're there.
Yeah.
And that we learn from that and recognize it.
I think that, yeah. Well, and that's, you see Berlin, a city that is actively working to help people remember. That's a discomfort that is probably good to have in your life.
But it's definitely intense, right? Like living in a place that has so much memory of the horrors that humanity has inflicted on one another.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the capacity. And then even as we try to make sense of various events in the world today, I think it really takes away some of that Pollyanna view of like, oh, it's all going to be fine. Mm.
And at the same time, the transition into a different culture and different rhythms is really disruptive on your own spiritual patterns. And,
yeah, absolutely. That.
And I'm really noticing that since we've come back. And if you would have asked me, I would have said, man, actually, I'm going to be working less when I get back to Berlin because I'm not going to be traveling. I won't be speaking in churches and trying to keep up with some of the other responsibilities. But there are other factors that feel super disruptive on just some of my spiritual patterns. I sit down and it's harder for me to come to stillness and interact with things the way I'm used to. And
I mean, for me, like not having my own office, whether at work or at home, I don't have my own office. Like there's just no space for that.
Yeah.
And like I have basically nowhere to be alone in this city, on this continent.
to be alone. Yeah. And so that's just even just the patterns as we're living with our adult children again, just the idea of what does it mean for me to find space or a time where I can sit and be quiet and reshaping so that I can carve that space out, which is absolutely vital for me to do in order to interact with some of the other spiritual realities of this city. But that disruption is also one of those factors that really increases the intensity of being back for me. Well, thanks, Stephen. I think we could bring this episode to a close unless you had something you wanted to...
This very cheery episode. Is that...
Woof. Yeah.
I think that's the... Goodness. I think the danger is having it be what a depressing episode. There are these critical factors, but there's an opposite danger of not acknowledging the reality of what does it mean to live in a place beyond the curated experience of a short-term trip.
Yeah, maybe I'll just say a little bit about that because I think they're like, why the intensity factors? Why do we want to pay attention to them? And I think part of it is that, so culture shock is hard. Moving to another culture is generally difficult, even if you want to. And if we, so the benefit of a tool like the intensity factors is being able to look around and to provide some differentiation between yourself and the experience of transition, or between the people around you and the experience of transition. Because what often will happen is we'll look for, I feel miserable, right? Like I feel awful. I'm unhappy. I used to be happy, right? And whose fault is it? Is it Joel's fault? Is it Kate's fault? Is it Mike's fault? Is it usually Steven's mine. Fault? Right? Like who
Mike? Mike?
Is it the landlord's fault? You said it's Mike's fault. Usually. But like really a lot of times what's happening is there's just this is the structure of cross-cultural transition. Is there's all this stuff that actually doesn't have anything to do with the people, yourself or anybody else. Right? It just is what it is. And if you can kind of differentiate that and say like, oh, I feel miserable because I'm experiencing this intensity factor, then that lets you have a little bit more peace with yourself and with the people around you. And I think that's really worth a lot.
And with God.
Yeah.
Because I think one of the things in those intensity factors when you're experiencing them is you're like, what's going on? I thought you called me to do this. And if I'm doing this, why is it hard? It shouldn't be.
Especially if we have an overdeveloped theology of triumphalism and an underdeveloped theology of suffering.
Yes.
But yeah.
Can I tell them the story about your sandals? Like our first few days here? Yes. Yeah, like my core memory. Just talking about like blaming, like where to point at what our problems are and things. Like my earliest memories of when we got here, the first few days, I just remember Kate washing dog poop off of her sandals multiple times in the tub.
Not from my dogs.
She kept stepping in it while we were out. And she said
that's another environmental intensity.
Right, right. It just like it'll wreck everything. And she was saying she found herself cursing the neighbors and anybody that was, you know, capable of not picking up after their dog, and how quickly that just it turned into this thing where you got to make a villain out of somebody that you didn't even know, and the need to kind of reorient and start praying for people that don't pick up their dog poop rather than curse them.
It's hard though, right?
It made it so much worse.
I'm here to share love with people, and then you're like, curse you!
Yeah, yeah.
what a beast, start.
You animal, you it was like, pick up after your dog.
I was told that everyone here is a good dog owner. I was told that every dog is good, and that mine are the bad ones, and it's like,
the dogs in Berlin don't poop.
Yeah. I don't think anybody told you that.
Yeah, so I know I'm like fighting this, like not mad at God, and not mad at Joel. It's just like, man, I miss being peaceful. And I miss like not being happy. I'm generally a happy person. But yeah, like the peacefulness of it. And like, I know 100% that, and I don't doubt it, that I'm called into this and called to Berlin. But man, I would like to not have that like anxiety in my chest. That'll come. We've seen like pinpricks of it, of like peacefulness, and it'll be there eventually, maybe.
It's been two weeks.
I mean, I think it'll be there, but I think the path there is hard.
It's been two years, actually. It's been two years.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I probably unwisely, it was like scrolling through my phone, like my pictures on my phone. It was like, when was the last time that I was like really like, oh, so peaceful? And it was unwisely, again, 2 years ago. In July, my friend and I went floating down the Niobrara, and it was just me and Michaela. And I remember sitting there by the water thinking like, oh, this is the best. I feel so peaceful right now. And I'm like, oh, crap. That was, I was like, I need to find something.
Was that while Joel was here?
It was after that. Okay. No, I was not peaceful when Joel was here. yeah, it was just like, what am I looking for though? And that was the question I've been like asking God, is like, what am I looking for? Like, what peace am I looking for? Just like easiness, comfort, like creature comforts, or what am I looking for? And I don't have an answer yet, but I'll let you know.
I think as we were going through the onboarding last week, and you know, one of the comments you guys made was, this is the weirdest onboarding I've ever been through because you're talking to us so much about not working.
Right. Yeah.
And I think it's exactly because of our experiences with that and the intensity of life in Berlin and the work that we do and the people that we're investing in and the hardness of figuring things out will constantly push you into finding a place where you think, well, here I can be competent and here I can exert some control, and that won't bring you that peace. At least in our experience, it hasn't. And so we are really intentional about trying to carve out time for that, which still, I mean, I would say still in and of itself doesn't work. saying, well, you know what, I'm going to take a day off.
Right.
It doesn't solve the problems that we're trying to solve, which is to prove our competency and our sense of belonging. Yeah. But it's forcing us to make space for the hard work to take place.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I've been wrestling with is like, what am I actually looking for? Yeah. Like, the last one on the list.
The spiritual.
Spiritual. Yeah. Realizing that I was missing our morning prayers that Joel and I was doing. And then also like waiting for God when his words are right in front of me. And so like, I know this is weird, but I don't like a Bible app because I'd rather just like read the paper, but then, it's really hard to find a Bible program without using the internet, like on like different, devotionals to use. But so I re-downloaded a Bible app and just like, okay, here's a devotional a week long on anxiety. Let's just go through that. And so like restarting these rhythms that are going to be the best answer for how I'm feeling right now. And it's not going to be immediate fix. And I want it to be like a magic wand and be like, Jesus, I've been good. Now give me my presence. Mm. Yeah. So it's just like, we've only been here for 2 weeks and I want to feel comfortable now. And that's not realistic. But yeah. So I really want to communicate with people. I'm really excited to start school. Cause I just want to communicate and read a sign.
Like
the street is damaged. Or this is not Italian sausage. This is a sausage from Italy. Do not use it the same.
That was so disappointing.
Well, thanks, guys. We're going to bring this episode to a close and then launch into another joyful episode that'll come out in 2 weeks.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you for joining us today on Tracks Cultures. If you enjoyed our conversation and want to dive deeper, we invite you to join our community on Discord. It's a space for sharing experiences, asking questions, and connecting with others who are navigating similar journeys. See the link in our show notes to become part of our growing community. Your support means the world to us. And if you'd like to help us continue our work as a creative community looking for the meeting place of faith, art, and culture, consider becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/envisionberlin to find out how you can contribute. Until next time, keep embracing change and embodying transformative hope for humanity.
This podcast was produced by Envision Berlin in our studios located in Berlin, Germany. If you'd like to send us a note, feel free to send your email to podcast@envisionberlin.com. Thanks for listening.